Thank you very much for the introduction and for the invitation. I actually find it strange to be at Moonee Valley. I spent my younger days here losing a lot of money very pleasurably, and I find it really strange to be back. I'm not going to address directly the question of whether there should be a community first party. Only once in my life did I think that I might form a party or form a small Senate ticket in which the number one ticket holder, luckily for him and for me, I never rang. It was going to be Tim Costello who I was going to ring and ask if he'd head the ticket, and I would agree to do the work and be number two. And that was in the 2001 election, when I still believed, I suppose, that a social justice ticket, as I understood it, would have some chance of at least affecting the campaign minimally. I have to say I don't believe that at present. And so what I wanted to do today is, I suppose, my fundamental belief in what I want to say is what Sir William Dean said on time and time again when he was Governor General, which is that a country in the end will be judged by the way it treats those who are weak, vulnerable, disadvantaged. And I suppose the text of my talk today is that as a society, at least politically, we seem to have forgotten that. So what I want to offer today is an analysis of the difficulties there would be in anyone thinking seriously about a community first party, or as I would like to call it, a social justice party. And then perhaps, having filled you with gloom, try and offer at the end of my very brief talk some grounds for hope, which come out of my own experience and the peculiarities of politics. Strange that Margaret Thatcher was mentioned, because that's where I want to begin. It seems to me no one who follows politics doubts that Margaret Thatcher changed the political landscape of Britain forever. And in my view, no one should any longer doubt that in Australia, John Howard has done the same to us. The more difficult question with John Howard is in what way. I want to give an outline of my view of how John Howard has changed Australia or Australian politics. As some of you will know, the term I use to describe Howard's impact on Australian political culture is conservative populism. In part, I mean by that Howard's willingness to ignore what I regard as the traditional liberal values he associates with a group he calls the elites, and to make a direct appeal, as in the case of Tampa, to the gut instincts of, in inverted commas, the people. In part, I mean that Howard is willing to treat with disdain the inconvenient opinion of experience, as he did, for example, with the 43 military chiefs and diplomats over Iraq, or former military chiefs and diplomats over Iraq. In part, I mean the way the Prime Minister has managed to forge a direct link with the people through the canny use of television soundbites and extensive personal appearances on the commercial radio programs of friendly talkback hosts. It's strange to me that a figure like Howard should have been, I think, the most populist Prime Minister we've had, even more than Bob Hawke, but that, I think, is the truth. There is, however, in my view, more to Howard's conservative populism than this. Although, of course, he's attentive to the requirements of business corporations and sensitive to the needs of the party's small business core constituency, as we can see now with the new industrial relations legislation that will pass soon. Under John Howard, the Liberal Party has, in my opinion, become integrally connected to suburban middle Australia. In part, this has been achieved through the selection of truly representative parliamentarians. I think of people like Joe Hockey or Jackie Kelly. And in part, and this is the part I want to dwell on, through the conspicuous rejection of the social justice post-Whitlam agenda. That is to say, through the conspicuous rejection of multiculturalism, Aboriginal self-determination and reconciliation, gay rights, uncompromising environmentalism and just treatment for refugees. Because it has been associated or become associated with the long economic boom that we still experience, the electoral impact of Howard's conservative populism has been profound. What we call rural and regional Australia is now generally under coalition control, federally speaking at least. While Labor dominates the cosmopolitan inner urban city seats, in the middle and outer suburbs of the capital cities of Australia, the electoral grip of the Liberal Party has been tightening from one election to the next. Western Sydney is all but conquered. Once solid seats, Labor seats in Melbourne's north and west have begun to move towards the Liberal Party. For the Labor Party, the depth of the crisis can no longer be denied. I belong loosely to a group that I would call the pro-Labor social justice left liberal intelligentsia. There's a mouthful for you. And we are in crisis. I want to talk about two responses to the crisis that came shortly after the election. The first was from Dr. Carmen Lawrence, a woman for whom I have profound respect. She argued that the Labor Party's fortunes could be reversed through the recruitment of a vibrant new party rank and file. I'm not convinced at all that this is the solution. In contemporary politics, there seems to be little connection between a party's electoral performance and its membership strength. With an identical rank and file, the Queensland Liberal Party dominates federal elections in their state, but performs abysmally at the level of the state. Even more importantly, if new members now flock to Labor, they would most likely come not from the suburbs, but from the inner city seats. The injection of these people, who I call cosmopolitans, would, if anything, widen the present gulf between the Labor Party and the great Australian suburban mortgage belt. An alternative left liberal analysis, again from a friend and someone I admire, came from Barry Jones. Barry Jones argues that since Keating, Labor has become almost ideologically indistinguishable from the coalition. To revive Labor's fortunes, he advocates in part a return to the Gough Whitlam Paul Keating program of progressive cultural reform. In my opinion, Jones has comprehensively underestimated the impact on Australia of the Howard years. Just as British Labor did not find its answer to Thatcherism by looking back to Harold Wilson or Michael Foot, Labor will not find its answer by returning to the social justice visions of the days of Gough Whitlam and Paul Keating. They were part of a different time. Now, it's not only Labor, but those concerned with social justice and environmental issues who are presently faced with a crisis of identity. It seems obvious to me, at least, and I'm very happy if you disagree with me, and even more happy if you convince me you're right. It seems obvious to me, at least, that many of the issues of greatest concern to us, if I can speak like that in this room, are of little interest or even anathema to the majority of our fellow citizens. This lack of interest or hostility does not reveal that in our concerns we are wrong. It does reveal, however, the existence of a fundamental contradiction between the political needs of Labor and the values of people of the left, which even the most eloquent flights of fancy cannot wish away. The contradiction that I have faced and faced bluntly since the last election can be stated like this. It is an almost ethical requirement of a two-party system that those participating strive for power. In order to win power in present circumstances, the Labor Party must reconnect with its blue-collar base and, even more importantly, regain the support it once held in Middle Australia during the Hawke years. It will not be able to do this on the basis of a program where the issues of greatest importance to those who are concerned with social justice, like myself, have a central or even a prominent place. In the era of Howard's conservative populism, there seems to me little alternative but for the Labor Party to move culturally, if not necessarily economically, to the right. If this is so, members of the social justice left, like myself, have in essence three political options from which to choose. The first is a movement to the Greens. The second is to remain inside Labor under the discipline of a self-denying ordinance, waiting for the arrival of more hopeful times. The third option is for the left, the progressive social justice left, to conduct the struggles for the causes in which it believes outside the framework of party politics, temporally at least. We are fortunate to live in a free society. There is no reason why those who still care about Aboriginal reconciliation, as one example, should not devote themselves to work at the grassroots. There is much to do. There is no reason why those who believe in multiculturalism and who are concerned with the growing anti-Muslim mood in this country should not involve themselves actively in intercommunal dialogue. There is no reason why those who believe in justice for refugees should not help those living in the purgatory of temporary visas to try to get on as well as possible with their lives. There is no reason why those who oppose the invasion of Iraq should not work against the propaganda of the government and the bias of the Murdoch media to create a public awareness of the frightening deterioration of conditions of life in that country. During the days of Hawke and Keating, the left liberal intelligentsia, probably became too reliant on the government for its support. What we ought to have learned since the election of Howard is that what governments can take, so they can take away. Just as the scope for action has narrowed in recent years, so has the need for action, independent of government and outside the framework of party politics, become even more vital in these unpropitious times. Now I turn towards hope. Are there grounds for reasonable hope here? Reflection on experience of the asylum seeker issue, the issue with which I've been most preoccupied since the last election, and for some time before that, has led me to think there are. Let me outline the problem, what these people have gone through. Between 1999 and 2001, about 12,000 or so asylum seekers reached or tried to reach Australia by boat. The overwhelming majority of these people had fled from Afghanistan under the Taliban, from Iraq under Saddam Hussein, or from the theocratic police state of Iran. Most of these people did reach Australia. Of these, the overwhelming majority spent several traumatic months or even years imprisoned in a remote or desert detention camp before being accepted as genuine refugees. For these people, the tragedy of their lives did not end at this point. All were given mere temporary protection visas, which meant they had no security, no sense of future, no right to travel, no right even to apply to be reunited with their families. A large number of these people are still living in a state of agonising uncertainty on these temporary visas. Some have been effectively forced to return to their homelands, to the chaos of Afghanistan or Iraq following the US-led invasions, or back to Iran. Others who are either too frightened to return or who are willing to leave Australia but have no country which will take them have spent the last 4 or 5 years in indefinite imprisonment. I have met many of these people. I have spoken at length to Australians who have befriended them. I've also read the studies of the psychologists and psychiatrists who have conducted research into their mental health. On the basis of all this, I feel I can say that their experiences in the detention centres have made them suffer grievously, and that the human spirit of some of them has been profoundly harmed, maybe even irreversibly destroyed. What is even worse than this is the simple fact that Australia's system for the treatment of asylum seekers, temporary visas, permanent imprisonment for failed asylum seekers, has been entirely purposeless. Since the implementation of the Pacific Solution in September 2001, only one asylum seeker boat with Vietnamese has reached Australian territory. Because the deterrence of asylum seekers has been almost 100% effective, the consignment of refugees to a condition of permanent temporariness and of failed asylum seekers to a state of permanent imprisonment is now not merely wicked, but also completely irrational from the policy point of view. If tomorrow every temporary protection visa holder was granted permanent residency, if tomorrow every detained asylum seeker was released from a detention centre, nothing untoward, even from the Howard government's point of view, would occur. One of the things that gives me hope is that human hearts are uneasy in the presence of injustice. The great untold story in the question of the refugees and asylum seekers is of the thousands upon thousands of Australians who have been committed to the fight for the well-being of the Middle Eastern and Central Asian asylum seekers and refugees. I think of the lawyers who work tirelessly pro bono. I think of the psychiatrists and doctors who have won the colleges of their profession to the cause. I think of the journalists in the ABC or Fairfax, and here I must mention Michelle Grattan as one of these, who have done all they can to keep the issue alive. I think of the citizens in the detention centre towns who have become almost permanent visitors to the detention centres to give comfort where they can. I think of the citizens in the wonderful and inventive groups like Rural Australians for Refugees or Australians Against Racism or Spare Rooms for Refugees. Even in the most unpromising political times, even when the government has seemed most unbending, even when the opposition has seemed too scared to take issue with that government, even when much of the media has seemed indifferent or bored, even when public opinion has seemed to be almost aggressively hostile, such people have never given up their struggle for justice or lost heart. Now, politics is a strange and unpredictable business. Who could have predicted that one of the people who would become entangled in the destructive detention system would be one of us? A permanent resident of Australia since the age of 18 months, suffering from an acute mental illness, whose dreadful experiences in the detention system would suddenly and finally illuminate for very many ordinary Australians what hundreds or thousands of outsiders have over the past 4 or 5 years gone through. And who could have predicted that a group of coalition backbenchers, led by one of the wiliest tacticians in the party, Petro Georgiou, would decide to risk the wrath of the Prime Minister and their colleagues by sponsoring exactly the kind of legislation that, if it is to regain its honour, this country now so desperately needs? It is too late to repair much of the damage we have done to the 12,000 or so who appealed after 1999 for our assistance. It is not too late to treat this group now with mercy by giving all of those in detention or on temporary visas permanent protection. Nor is it too late to pass legislation which will prevent anything like the recent disaster to recur. Yet in this talk, this is not really my main point. Even the fact that there is now a slim prospect of the Georgiou legislation being passed relied upon the very many thousands of Australians fighting for what they believed was right, outside the limits set by party politics, and despite what has appeared to be, and still is, the desperately unpropitious nature of the times. I know that there are hundreds of people in this room whose lives are devoted to different civil society actions of such a kind. I have only two things I can say to you. You have my deep respect and always be of good heart. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. And you might want to stay up there in a minute because Michelle's now going to interrogate you. I don't know if that's the right word. But anyone who's had even a passing interest in politics knows our next guest, Michelle Grattan, who's the doyen of political reporting in this country and has been so for 30 years. Her reputation for integrity, fairness, accuracy and sheer hard work is indeed legendary. Michelle joined the Age Bureau in the Canberra Press Gallery in 1971. That was after she was my tutor in politics in my first year at university and her first year as a tutor. She became the first female editor of a metropolitan daily newspaper in Australian history when Michelle was appointed editor of the Canberra Times in 1993, before returning to the Age in 1995 as political editor. Michelle is currently a political columnist at The Age and essential reading and highly influential. Last year, Michelle received an Order of Australia Award for her services to journalism through commentary on politics and government and analysis of Australian civic life. Michelle, you're going to explore with Robert further his presentation. As Michelle said, it's Meet the Press, but one press.
Well, perhaps, Robert, I could start with going back to the early part of your analysis. I wonder how you account, you mentioned the revival of Petro Giorgio and moderate action, but how do you account for the decline of the moderates in the Liberal Party, as well as the relegation, if you like, of left thinking in the Labor Party? Now, neither strand of thinking, the moderates or the Labor left, were dominant in their parties, but it does seem to me that in earlier times they were much more forthright and forthcoming than we're basically seeing these days, with the exception of this latest event. What would you, how would you account for that?
Well, the general explanation is that I do think the times have moved to the right. It's a hard thing to demonstrate. No two people would have exactly the same idea of what being right means. But I nevertheless see the present era as a kind of return to a much more conservative time throughout, certainly the English-speaking world, and thus people on the left of both parties have probably been sidelined as a result. My own view is, I think that as Howard sees himself as the most conservative leader of the Liberal Party probably ever in terms of the circumstances of his time, he has either drummed left Liberal people out of his party, I think of people like Chris Puplik and others, Ian McPhee, or those who were once, smaller Liberals like Robert Hill and Philip Ruddock, it's sort of hard to believe, have, in the interests of their careers, changed with the way they have to go. So I think within the Liberal Party that is the case. I suppose, to me, a turning point in the country's history was the Tampa crisis, and I think at that point the leadership, and it didn't really matter whether it was Beazley or Latham or Crean, realised that the issues, the social justice issues of the left in the Labor Party, were precisely those issues that could be wedged by the coalition and which would do the desperate damage to the party. And I think in that way the left, if the left was strong on the issues that I mentioned, environmental issues or issues of Aboriginal reconciliation, let alone asylum seekers, everyone knew it would do the Labor Party harm, as indeed the environmental forest issue did in Tasmania in the last election. So I think for those reasons, the left of both parties have been marginalised or adapted to the new circumstances.
Just going into your own domain, I get the impression over the last 10, even 20 years, that the universities, for example, have become much more fraught and pressed and economically rationalist in the activities of many of the academics. Do you think that this is a factor in the decline of small L liberalism more widely, because that intellectual community in the past, I think, provided ideas, critical mass, all that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, the universities are complicated. The things are getting more complicated the closer you are to them and see them up close. I think that the faculties I understand, which are humanities, social sciences, are still very much of the left. It's reasonably rare to find non-left-wing people in those faculties. But most of, I think what's happened in universities is that careers are only advanced by publications and by doing things within one's own discipline. And I think that the academics on the left have acted in a way self-servingly. They advance their careers by speaking within a very small group, but fewer and fewer of them seem to have the interest or the capacity to speak to the general public. So I'm really quite unusual, I think, in having given part of my life to trying to be both a university person and a person in the public realm. And I think it's largely to do with the pressures of career more than the pressures of ideology or economic rationalism.
Well, do you think in that case that being what we might call a public intellectual helps or hampers you in a university career? What has been your experience of that?
Well, my experience was when, you know, I've got this book, Left, Right, Left. When I was on the right, it harmed me a lot. That is because of the content of my opinions, which were very unpopular. Since I'm not on the right and sort of, you know, kind of on the left, it's actually done nothing but good. Because, you see, the economic pressures on the university are to be noticed, and the fact that one of its members is prominent in the media, say, is now regarded by universities as a great marketing device.
So you don't have to be liked by John Howard.
You don't have to.
You mean, so long as you're there, it doesn't matter whether he likes you or doesn't like you.
No, that's right. I mean, I suppose if I was a terrorist, that might cause troubles to the university. But insofar as I argue in a respect, you know, reasonably respectful way, and within the mainstream media, I've found it does my place at the university nothing but good, and the university has treated me very well. I mean, there's some envy, but that's a different issue.
I wonder if you could hypothesise and just think back on previous Liberal leaders, especially Robert Menzies. What do you think Robert Menzies' attitude would be to the asylum seeker issue?
Well, I'm not confident that it would be more Liberal. It's very hard to know because the times have changed so much, but the only Liberal leader of whom I'm confident the attitude would be different is Malcolm Fraser. I mean, I think there's a certain about everyone in the Liberal Party wants to mythologise Robert Menzies, but in fact, on many issues, particularly in the last 5 years of his life, he was very conservative in a way that I don't like, and on questions, say, of apartheid, and questions of the black takeover of the Commonwealth as he saw it. He was very conservative, and I suspect if you transfer his mood, not so much his ideas, but his mood into the present times, I'm not sure he would be a great Liberal in regard to the asylum seeker issue. So it's a sort of disappointing thing to believe, but it's kind of what I do.
Now, I noticed you mentioned the possibility of a flight to the Greens, but obviously the minor parties really don't offer much hope of a broader view in the system these days, do they? The Democrats are virtually gone, the Greens are out there, but arguably have even peaked. How important do you think the government's control of the Senate is in where minority opinion can get a voice these days? Do you think that this is going to be a major disaster for some of these causes, or not much of one? How do you see it?
Well, one of my favourite sayings came from Irving Kristol, which he said something like, it's disappointing to not get what you want, but sometimes when you get what you want, that's even more dangerous. And I think that the Howard government may now overplay its hand. I think the country will be transformed. I think John Howard will use the last two or three years, or however long he stays, to do things that he has been blocked from doing in areas like media regulation, industrial relations, privatising Telstra. But many of the things that he hasn't been able to do are things that I think might turn out to be deeply unpopular when he actually does them. So that the fact that he now has control of the Senate, or his government does, means that things might be done of a radicalism that for 10 years almost he's been unable to do. And therefore I think it's not impossible that a rallying of the community on all sorts of issues might come about. I think that the country will be transformed by Howard's control. I think he'll use it, he'll always say I'm doing it moderately, but he'll use it with great determination to change the country in what I regard essentially as an American direction. But I think he also might find that because Australians are not Americans, some of the things he will do may actually weaken the coalition substantially and even cause perhaps rifts within the Liberal Party and maybe even in the coalition between Nationals and Liberals.
Can I come to a more personal political question? You mentioned, and it's encapsulated in your latest book, your own political journey. What were the dynamics of this, and how do you look back on what you've said in previous times? And do you think that Malcolm Fraser made a similar journey, or do you think we misinterpreted him when he was in power?
How many hours do you have? How can I say? There are a number of different things. Putting it very simply, I was on the right largely because of the communist issue, and I still think the same way about the communist movement and the Soviet Union. I think I was probably wrong about economic rationalism when I was opposed to it. I didn't understand the dynamics of the economy properly. I was changed from left to right by a number of things, most importantly Aboriginal reconciliation, I suppose. With Malcolm Fraser and me, I think our trajectories have been similar. Just the very simple answer to it is there's always a question of how far you have changed, how far the culture has changed. My view is that I've changed and the political culture has shifted. So both things have been in movement. Malcolm tends to say only the culture has shifted and I've remained the same. And I don't think that's true, in fact. I think he has shifted. And I think on questions that he mainly talks about now, he has moved a fair degree to the left, for which I'm profoundly grateful.
It sounds like he's being a politician in his rationalisation.
Yes, yes.
So you've mentioned Petro's bills. Do you see any chance of something positive coming out of that? Do you think that for reasons of its own, the government actually wants to deal with some of these asylum seekers still incarcerated? Or do you think that that was just Howard on the day trying to find some way of getting through the day, and that Amanda Vanstone's view of yesterday, which was a tougher one, is actually the government's position?
I think John Howard pretends to be willing to make moves and will occasionally. I mean, people have been released for the last few months. Now, none of the asylum seekers know why it's them and not someone else, but it's been happening and that will presumably continue to happen. I think Howard is just trying to find the way in which he can defeat Petro's move, and I think he probably will. But I don't think the issue really is releasing the odd person here and there, which definitely the government has done and will continue to do. The issue is whether the legislation will change and whether the attitude towards it will change. And there I'm confident that Howard and Vanstone are of one mind, which is they defend the present system.
And he just puts it a little less
harshly. He just puts it more moderately and more cannily than she did last weekend.
Have you looked at all at these these latest moves to cut back the appeal system, and do you have a view on those?
Well, I've looked at them very cursorily, and I think that insofar as ever since Ruddock was Minister for Immigration, one of the main determinations has been to try and break the legal rights of asylum seekers, and I think it's a unjust thing because it's at some points the only thing they have to rely upon.
Do you concede, though, that there is a problem when quite a large number of cases do clog up and delay the system, and most of those tend to be, or many of them tend to be lost.
Yeah, I see that as a problem, but the
So how do you deal with that?
You give all temporary protection visa holders permanent visas, and you let all those in detention centre out on permanent visas. I don't think there's any grounds at all for the way we've treated asylum seekers. And what I was trying to say in my remarks is there is no problem. Basically, Australia doesn't have any asylum seekers anymore. And insofar as you keep the Pacific solution going, then we won't have any asylum seekers in the future. Nothing at all would be lost. From an act of mercy, I'd call it.
But are you saying you should keep the Pacific solution going as a deterrent? Are you saying that?
I'm saying that, no, I don't think, but there would be problems, but I know that neither party would change the Pacific solution. And while it's in place, those who were the victims of the last deterrent system that didn't work should just be released, and there'd be no legal tie-up. The courts would be free. And there are only a few hundred people now involved.
So how do you deal with the question of deterrence and also the question of overstayers, who are really a separate category?
I think I have no complaints about the way overstayers are treated if they can be speedily deported.
Right.
The question of I'm not in favour of the Pacific solution, and I wish it had never been introduced, because I think on balance, people having the right to flee is fundamental to the post-war order, but I'm not going to win that one. And it seems to me more important humanly to look to those who got here and who are now suffering in different ways, which is the purpose of Petro's bill.
I'm told we've talked too long.